I'm Steve Martin. The second hour, we're talking to Allison Brown. And Allison has been a guest on Unreal Bluegrass before. Phenomenal historian, musician, composer, you name it. Her new album On Banjo, which is, of course, on Compass label. We'll talk about that because it's hers. I ask each artist before these segments to pick out three songs. And then we can start out with one. We can go to a second and a third one. The first one she picked out, which I kept mispronouncing, and she very politely corrected me, Foggy Morning Breaking, which I did fall into the Foggy Mountain Breakdown, and she corrected me very nicely. It's Foggy Morning Breaking. It's on Banjo with Allison, and this features that other guy named Steve Martin. Thanks so much for tuning in. To the audience of Unreal Bluegrass, you just heard, I think, the first single released from an album from an artist, one of my favorite artists. We're going to talk to Allison Brown, but the audience just heard Foggy Mountain Breaking. It's I think it was the first single released off of Allison Brown's new release On Banjo. And I have always happy to have Allison Brown available to chat about all kinds of stuff, music. And On Banjo gives us a lot of opportunity to look into some of those things. How are you, Allison?
I'm doing great. It's great to hear your voice again and get to talk to you over the phone, at least. Well, I'll look forward to the next opportunity in person.
Yeah, I'm always glad when you have time to chat a little bit. Number one, I just love chatting with you in general, as we did off the air. But your albums are so full of so many things to look into, and we're going to look into some of them. But you come in with so many different approaches and so many things that you brought in that you've absorbed to bring into the music. And I think On Banjo is a perfect example of what I would expect from one of your albums. It includes so many different types of music and different styles, and you have so many good reasons for what you're doing. We're going to talk about, I love the Jobim music that we're going to talk about. I love the bossa nova and the samba sound. We'll talk about that a little bit so the audience knows why is he bringing these up now. But I think this is, well, there's 10 tunes. I think you've written them all. You've combined a couple tunes for Sun and Water, which we'll get to that in a little bit later. But the tune we just heard, Foggy Mountain Breaking, is, I think that was the first. Was that the first single that was released?
Oh, okay. Well, it wasn't exactly the first single. The first single that we put out was Sun and Water.
Sun and Water. Yeah,
okay. Just a minute ago.
That's right.
I think we're going to maybe get to that one a little bit later on.
Yeah, we will. Absolutely. We will talk about that because I want to touch on your influences with Jobim, which just I love. I love it. So Foggy Mountain Breaking, that was one that maybe it was more I saw the video of Sun and Water, and I think that maybe the breaking of no pun intended, Foggy Mountain Breaking, it became more visible because of the person that you co-wrote and performed it with.
Yes. Well, actually, you know, the tune is actually called, and this is intended to be confusing, it's called Foggy Morning Breaking.
Oh, and, yeah, I have that written down right in front of me, and I read it Foggy Mountain.
Yeah, no worries, because I say that half the time, too, because we're also used to saying Foggy Mountain Breakdown.
Yes.
Yeah, if you know one thing about the banjo, it's Foggy Mountain Breakdown.
That's right, that's right.
But, right, I co-wrote this tune with Steve Martin, and when we were trying to pick a title for it, I suggested Foggy Morning Breaking because it's a lyric that comes from the John Hartford song Down on the Levee. And I knew that Steve had a history with John on the Smothers Brothers show.
Oh, yeah, great.
Way back in the late 60s. And the studio that we actually recorded it in is our studio at Compass, which was the Glazer Brothers studio, which was where Outlaw Country kind of coalesced and sort of the birthplace of Outlaw Country. But also, most importantly to me, is where John recorded his steam-powered aeroplane record.
Wow.
And it was actually the royalties that the Glazer Brothers got from publishing John's song Gentle on My Mind that built the studio. So I feel like John Hartford is very much of
a
strong background presence in everything I do every day. Just he's very much present in our studio and space.
And that's you mentioned Compass Records, and I was going to make sure that we mentioned the label. And of course, it's a label that you're involved in ownership, and also so many great tunes and so many great genres of music that you brought into Compass. But you've mentioned that I didn't know about the John. By the way, I think anybody that had a piece of the royalties from General on My Mind from John probably did okay.
Yes, it's a pretty big studio.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah, good.
It's not that big a studio, but it's a really nice studio, and I love the story, and I love the connection, and I love the fact that you know, that we get to occupy a space that was built by people who took a chance on outlying, on an outlier song.
Yeah.
Because nobody would publish Gentle on My Mind. John went around to everybody on Music Row, and everyone thought it had too many words. And as you probably know, it's one of the most recorded songs in Western music.
It's been recorded a bazillion times and covered and heard in every, well, that's, I didn't know you had a hard time, getting attention for it. That's just nuts. Well, so yeah. Then that explains too, well, the tuning on this, Foggy Morning Breaking is double C. And I want to ask you about that because it's both you and Steve Martin are in double C tuning. And just for the audience, explain that briefly and why you wanted to come at it with, Steve, who does more of the open back or the frailing type with the double C tuning. Was that, I guess that has to then do with, John Hartford was also in a lower tuning most of the time.
Right. So, okay. So for anybody who's not already a banjo geek who's listening in bluegrass music, the banjo is generally tuned to an open G chord. And John would often take his banjo and tune it to an open E chord. So the way he did that, though, was just by taking the G chord and moving all the strings down a step and a half so that when you played the third string, instead of it being a G on your tuner, it would be an E. So you could play all the same licks and things out of on the low E tuning as you could out of the G tuning. And the great advantage to that was that John could play like the open rolling Scruggs licks and accompany his baritone vocals out of the key of E because he had a lower voice.
Yeah.
So that gave him the flexibility to have that low rolling sound with his banjo and still sing. But in this case, with this tune, the double C tuning is a little bit different thing. I've heard it called the sawmill tuning occasionally, and it's something that's really popular with clawhammer players, maybe less popular with three-finger players, but it's always been one of my favorite tunings to mess around with, and I knew that Steve was really partial to that tuning. And Steve is, in addition to his other many, many, many talents, is also a fantastic banjo player and has the most delicate touch on his clawhammer playing, even though he's kind of a unicorn because he plays great three-finger and great clawhammer. And his clawhammer playing especially, I just love. Yeah. And one of my passions is three-finger playing and clawhammer together, so that's how that all came to be. That was a long-winded answer for you.
No, that's a good answer, and I agree with you on Steve's playing. He has a very different styles on both the five-finger and, the bluegrass and the clawhammer thing. But I happen to think his clawhammer is more adept at the way he thinks. And this is way too analytical, but I think he just seems to think and play and compose so much better with that type of a banjo. It just seems to fit him. The melodies that he writes on a clawhammer, I like better than the other stuff that he writes. Although he does both well, but I do think that for some reason he communicates better with a clawhammer sound. I really do.
Well, it's interesting because obviously Steve is a great writer of words, but he's also a great writer of music. And when I sent him the A section of that tune and asked if he would write a B section, I mean, I was just blown away at how great the B section was in terms of its musical answer to the A section. Yeah. That doesn't always happen when you collaborate with someone, but he really pulled the right threads of it forward to my ear anyway, and I love what he wrote.
I think he writes great melodies, and you both do it well together. And obviously, you've worked with him in the past. I think if not on record, certainly enough to know how his mind works and what he's going to do.
Well, I don't know if I could claim to know how his mind works, but I have had the honor of getting to collaborate with him
That's a good way to put it.
So, and I know that whenever I have the chance to be out doing a show with Steve, the banjos are always going to come out in the dressing room. They're always going to be in double C tuning, and it's just so fun. It's just so fun to play, double banjos in that tune, I think. And really, a lot of the inspiration for that goes way, way back to kind of my very early days with the banjo when I heard the Circle album and heard John McEwen and Earl Scruggs do that duet on Soldier's Joy. I feel like I've been trying to recreate the magic of that, like, my whole career. but putting two banjos together and having one playing clawhammer, one playing three-finger in that double C tuning is it's just so special to me. I think it's really magical.
I'll tell you how stupid I am, and that'll take way too long, but I'm so stupid that when I started playing a banjo in the early 70s, I didn't know anything about it except that it was a banjo. And I would listen to John Hartford, and I kept thinking, that note's not on here. Where is that deeper? And I had no idea you were allowed to retune your banjo. It didn't occur to me. I thought, I'm going to stick to this. And I kept thinking, that note doesn't exist. And that's what he was doing. It took me forever someone said, you know, he's just retuning this. And I thought, geez, I would have liked to have known that 10 years ago. I couldn't figure it out on my own.
You know, well, how isolated I was. I wasn't even really tuned into what John was doing at all. It took me a while to come to John's playing. He wasn't one of, like, the initial inspirations to me. I mean, that was like all Earl Scruggs, Tony Trischka, Alan Mundy, John Hickman, just the guys who were playing amazing three-finger style and conventional tuning. I discovered John later on, and then, you know, if I had heard him early on, I don't think that there's any way that I would have figured it out either. So don't feel bad about that. And one of the things that I think is really great is how you're hearing more low banjo cropping up in bluegrass music now. So I think there are probably a whole new generation of fledgling banjo players that are scratching their heads over the same thing.
I think so. Are you playing? I remember when you started playing a banjo that was built by Deering that was specifically a low tuning banjo, which is also a word that we use in this album. Were you playing the Julia Bell banjo, which was kind of like that John Hartford model?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. Okay. So a couple of years ago, well, more than a couple, a handful of years ago, my husband Gary gave me John Hartford's prototype Deering low banjo as a birthday gift, and it's an instrument that I've been had been borrowing from Mark Howard for a while. And this was after John had passed away. I think that maybe Mark inherited it, and I kept calling up Mark and asking him if I could borrow it for sessions because it was just has such a great way that it sits in the track, unlike a G banjo that you've got that pinging fifth string all the time. Mm-hmm. With the lower tuning, it's just got kind of this nice pleasant roll and growl that really sits nicely with everything. And so so long story short, I ended up being the very proud owner of that instrument, and I was using it a lot and afraid to take it out on the road. So I went to Deering and said, well, let me just go ahead and buy one of your John Hartford model banjos. They sent me one, and it was obviously a great instrument because I think they make fantastic banjos. Mm-hmm. But I had some ideas for how it could be made a little bit more to what I'm used to. So I went to Janet and Greg at Deering and asked if they wanted to collaborate on a version 2.0 of the John Hartford banjo. And that was how the Julia Bell came about.
Okay.
And I use that banjo a lot, and I meant for it to be a tribute to John. So I got together with John's daughter, Katie, and she let me go through her archives of her dad's artwork. John was a fine artist. He actually went to art school, and he left behind a lot of really amazing sketches. And he loved the paddle wheelers, the riverboats.
Yeah.
And so in these boxes, I found hundreds of doodles of paddle wheelers. So I picked out my favorite one, and that became the inlay on the 12th fret. And then I found a sketch that he did of Captain Trone, who was the pilot of the Julia Bell Swain, which is the paddle wheeler that John first piloted on the Mississippi River. Yeah. And Captain Trone taught him how to do it. So Captain Trone's a little sketch that John did of Captain Trone's on the 5th fret.
Oh.
And then we used a sketch, another sketch that I think might have been used on the Girl in the Blue Velvet Band record. That became the peghead image. And so we kind of put all these images together, and that's why we called the banjo the Julia Bell.
I think I remember when it came out. I think I saw you at an IBMA thing when it was just hitting.
It's a great banjo because, like I said, well, Deering makes great banjos, but also the legacy that John left me personally, especially with our studio and the space that I'm in every day when I'm at Compass Records, I just feel, you know, John's presence even more strongly than I did when he was alive, which is interesting. And so it's just wonderful to play his legacy forward through that instrument. And it's been great to see other banjo players get their hands on it. I know when I'm working on special consensus records now, Greg always brings in his Julia Bell banjo, and we've been able to do some really grassy things with it. We cut a version of a John Hartford tune called Way Down the River Road on their record 2 or 3 records ago. And when that thing kicks off, I think it's definitely going to be one of those situations where a banjo player who's just starting out is listening to that and doesn't get that it's low tune banjo. It's just like, it sounds like a driving grassy banjo. So it's really cool to have that extra voice in there.
For a listener, I'm talking to Alison Brown, which I always enjoy, and we're going to go through some more of the On Banjo album, which is the most recent release. And we've been talking, we started off talking about the Foggy Morning Breaking tune, and now we're talking about banjos, which happens a lot on Unreal Bluegrass, plus with somebody like Alison Brown on the phone. I enjoy that so much. I enjoy just talking to you about banjos thing, because I know that you're so advanced into what you're listening to and what you're picking up. On on banjo. I have to do like air quotes or just make it clear, distinct. So let's say in the album on banjo, so I don't say on twice. You do a lot of some of your tunes. There are several on here that pull from, I'm gonna say collectively, South American jazz, samba, bossa nova type sounds. But you definitely have an affinity for the music that Joe Beam did and some other people. When you actually write a song, which happens to be a personal favorite of mine, banjo Beam. I don't know, which I'm going to talk about in a second, but you also, the tune we're going to lead up to here in a little bit, I will have you introduce it, not just yet, Sun and Water. You combine, Here Comes the Sun and Waters of March. So you've got the Beatles thing, and then you've got the Joe Beam thing. And that also has a low banjo. That's why I'm skipping to this now. So you have, and then you also have Shoro. I pronounce it Shoro enough, the second cut on the album, which is, again, I consider that to be, here's what, let me make this so you understand my introduction to this sound. I would say Stan Getz, Charlie Berg, Cal Jader, to a certain extent, they brought some sounds back that we just didn't know here. And I don't know if the timing of Stan Getz and the girl from Ipanema were the same time. Maybe, I don't remember, but so I hear all this music coming from jazz players that bring it back. And you are definitely into that sound, and you do it so well. It fits so well into the jazzy setup that you have on many of these tunes.
Well, thank you. You know, it's kind of an enigma to me why I'm drawn so much to that music, because I grew up in Southern California, so it's not like I got to grow up in Rio or something like that. But I just love the rich harmony of, especially like the bossa nova music and Joe Beam's music and those guitar voicings. And I've got like the Joe Beam songbook. Hamish Stewart, who I guess I was hanging out with Hamish Stewart and Colin Hay. It was maybe the year before the pandemic, and they were on tour with the Ringo All-Star Band. And we work with Colin Hay on Compass, and we also put out a couple of Hamish's records too, actually, early on. So we had a relationship with both those guys, and we were over at Carter Vintage Guitars one afternoon after we'd gone to lunch. And Hamish happened to mention that there's actually a Joe Beam two-volume chord book, like all those tunes with the guitar tablature. So I got that like as soon as he mentioned it. And that particular day during the pandemic, I finally had time to open it up and dig into some of those chord voicings. And Waters of March, like the way that starts off that guitar part, you know, it's just so awesome. And so I was learning exactly how that was voiced. And as I was messing with that, I was also playing around with the tune Here Comes the Sun, because I was thinking about it because I was on a Zoom call with some friends who are doctors up in New York, talking about the, you know, dealing with the very, very early days of COVID and being in the hospitals up there in New York City, and how they were playing Here Comes the Sun when they were discharging patients that recovered. And so I was kind of had the two tunes in my head at the same time. And then I started to realize that they really did have a musical kind of kinship with each other. And that's how that kind of merging of those two tunes came together. But yeah, the Joe Beam chord book, that if it hadn't been for that book and kind of really trying to drill into those harmonies, I don't think that I would have even thought to put the two songs together.
And it's a perfect seamless transition from one to the other. I mean, it's just I love it. I love the music that you do, but being able to hear that, and maybe that's it. Maybe that's it, Allison, that you had the chord book there and the, there was a connection that was drawn. But it's such a great combination of Here Comes the Sun and the Waters of March. And I think most listeners would have heard some point in their life, at least the melody to Waters of March. It does have words. I've heard it sung in Portuguese and English, but I bet you the tune, everybody probably recognizes the melody. So it's a perfect melding. I mean, all the things I like about it. I got Beatles and I got Joe Beam.
Well, that's so great. I feel the same way. It's how powerful to be able to write a melody that kind of transitions time and place and extends beyond time and place, I should say, I guess. Because I think that Waters of March must have been written in the 60s.
Yeah.
And Here Comes the Sun was probably written in the 60s too, maybe. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So, I mean, so how amazing to write melodies that still have resonance, you know, what, 60 years after they were written.
That's a good point. I mean, because when I referenced Stan Getz, again, that was in the 60s, the one Stan Getz was, yes. was recording those tunes that really kind of brought, at least to me and maybe a lot of the world, to the bossa nova sound. That was in the 60s. Charlie Byrd, who actually, you know, was a great guitar player and did a lot of Joe Beam stuff, was also the early 60s. And the Cal Jader thing I talked about was in the 60s. So everybody's kind of doing the same. All the influences, I guess, are washing into the minds at the same time. But it is funny that Here Comes the Sun still matches up well with Waters of March. You know, you and I keep talking about Joe Beam. It's not a person named Joe Beam.
That's a really good point.
It just occurred to me that we've not even said his full name. So he has a book of chords. He has great songs, but it's not Joe Beam. Tell the listener just a brief on Antonio, because they'll go out looking for Joe Beam or Joseph Beam.
I am really so glad you said that. Right. So his full name was Antonio Carlos Joe Beam. Joe Beam was his last name. And I'm really glad you said that, because I did an interview once a long time ago. And I was talking about having taken a music one class in college and hearing the like church music of Buxtehude, which is like one of these, that's like a college word, right? That's the kind of thing you forget after the exam. And then not too long after that, I was running into people asking me like where you could find Bucks music. And of course he was just some like, I don't know, maybe not so obscure, but seemingly obscure to me sitting here in Nashville in 2023, composer and organist, I think like in the 1500s. So I'm really glad that you clarified that. Okay. But yeah, you're right. So I was, while you were talking, I was just looking up on a little internet search, and so Here Comes the Sun was came out in 1969, and Waters of March came out in 1972, but Girl from Ipanema was released in 1962. Yeah. So it is interesting, like no doubt George Harrison would have heard Bossa Nova. I'm sure he would have been into it too. Because then that music is like, it's like ear candy. It's so beautiful.
It is.
I mean, how could anyone not like that? Your listeners all need to go out and check out Waters of March. I mean, it's one of the best tracks ever.
In his playing was so, it's so smooth. And you talk about all the chords that he played. It was such an inviting sound, but you know, he's really busy working cleanly and on the left hand and all the stuff he did. He was a great, I think he was great, great. I think he was a pretty good singer. I also thought he was underrated as a player by a lot.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. There's just a real kind of everyman sort of quality to it. It's just so beautifully laid back. I don't know. It's just, I could listen to that song anytime, anywhere, on repeat. So good.
Well, let me do this then, since we're talking about Joseph Beam and his legacy. let's talk about Banjo Beam. I'm going to skip down to the eighth cut, which is a tune that you wrote. You wrote it on a guitar, and then you played. And I have a banjola now. Again, I don't know how you put nylon strings on it. Was it made that way? But that tune is just that's a great response to Joe Beam. And you've done it on a banjo, and you're playing it on a nylon string banjola, which I want to ask you about the tune, but I also want you to explain the banjola and the nylon strings and why that makes perfect sense.
Well, I'm glad you think it makes perfect sense. I really wasn't sure how to articulate that melody on a banjo, but I just knew that since I had written the tune, well, first of all, I thought of the title, Banjo Beam. It never occurred to me how close the word banjo and Joe Beam are to each other. So once I thought of the title, I had to write the tune. And yeah, it was definitely, you know, easier to come up with those kinds of harmonies on a guitar than on a banjo. But then I had the challenge of knowing that I needed to play it on the banjo because of the title. And regular banjo was just too staccato for it. So I reached for my banjola, which is it's essentially an all wood banjo. Mm-hmm. So there's no metal on it. And that way it's more like a guitar, I guess. Although it's shaped round, it's a round shape like a banjo. It's got a round sound hole. Mm-hmm. Although the strings on this banjola are steel strings. They're very light, like light guitar strings, really.
Yeah.
And so when you play it, it sounds like a guitar, kind of. But if you play guitar, you're like, oh, that's not quite a guitar. What is it? And it kind of has a dulcimer sort of tone to it sometimes,
And it's
got a really nice sustain. Yeah,
it does. And I also think that it would be made perfectly for this type of music, because the notes don't decay as quickly. Exactly. So you really can't get into something. So it's all right. Go ahead. You put nylon strings on it for this occasion? Mine has the very light strings that I bought it with a zillion years ago. But explain why the nylon strings makes more sense to you as you're playing this banjo being.
Well, so actually they're, it does make sense that there you could do it with nylon strings, but this I played with steel strings on the. This banjo is set up for steel strings, so I do have another banjo that's a electric nylon string banjo.
Oh,
but I really wanted this to be acoustic, so
this is
steel string. Okay. But what's so very cool is that next week I have a meeting with Deering because we've been talking about developing a new banjola, kind of taking this, the one that I have, which was built for me by Edward Dick out in Colorado, maybe 15, maybe even 20 years ago. And kind of now that I've used it more, I have some ideas for how to make it just an even better instrument for banjo players looking for a different sonic option. Because when you play the banjo, sonic options is a good thing to have.
And I'm talking to Allison Brown again, if you're just tuning in. You typically you do everything on the banjo, but the songs that I am more comfortable with, you play, we'll make this distinction and we're not going to labor a lot, but you play closer to the neck than to the bridge, and that makes a sound difference. And on a lot of the stuff that you're playing on this album, I think, except for maybe the thing you do with Stuart Duncan, but you have a style that fits so well, and you're so beautifully play the tunes up close to the neck, and that makes a difference. Tell the listeners why real quickly, and I want to move on to one other thing so I don't take all your day.
Yeah, no, for sure. Well, you know, I think one of the most important things to do if you're a banjo player is to really listen to the different voices that the instrument has. And when I play bluegrass, you're right, I tend to keep my hand closer to the bridge just the way all bluegrass players would, because that's how you get that kind of Earl Scruggs, really punchy sound. But as you move your hand towards the neck, you get maybe a little bit more resonance out of the instrument and a warmer sound, maybe a little bit fatter sound. And depending on what you're doing, you know, there's different spots that you can put your hand, like between the bridge and the neck, that give the right lyrical voice for the tune. So I just try to be aware of that. And you're right, certain tunes I find that I'll play closer to the neck, and other tunes, if it's more grassy tune, like you mentioned, Tall Hog at the Trough. That one merits a full out bluegrass.
Absolutely does.
Stick your finger close to the bridge.
And that's one that, since you mentioned, that's like kind of a you and Stuart Duncan again, for you have a long history together, but that was a great, I don't know Tall Hog at the Trough. I'm not sure. I also don't know quite what Old Shatterhand means. And so you mentioned in the liner notes that the members of the band should know. I don't get it.
Oh, okay. Well, that tune actually started off as a kind of an exercise that I wrote for myself to have some changes to practice single string, like jazz lines over. And then it ended up being so fast that it's like really almost, it's not a good practice tune for that at all. And as we started to try to play it, I mean, what I was thinking the tune should be called Bird on a Wire, just kind of like riffing off the idea of a girl playing single string stuff on her five wire banjo. But when it became clear that it was not that at all, then I decided to call it Old Shatterhand, kind of riffing off of Old Dangerfield, that Bill Monroe tune in the title.
Okay.
Yeah, and
I thought somebody broke their fingers in the process of learning this.
Well, try to play it and then you might break your fingers, because I know that I do, I end up with a sore thumb or something else. Because it is a finger twister for sure, and it moves along at such a clip that getting all those notes in there is a Shatterhand opportunity.
Well, we've talked a little bit about Sun and Water. You've pretty much set it up. If you do just a real quick intro to that, we'll play that for the audience, and I'm going to come back and talk to you just a little bit more as we go. So Sun and Water, you've talked about how it came about, but you might want to do a real short intro to that. We'll play that, and then...
Right, so Sun and Water is... was an opportunity to take two of my favorite melodies and put them together. And I didn't set out to do that. It was more that I was working on a little bit of Here Comes the Sun during the pandemic. And then I was also digging into my Jobim chord book and playing Waters of March and learning those chord voicings. And I was doing that at the same time. And in the process of doing that, I realized that the two tunes, there's bits of melody that are almost the same in both tunes. So I thought, why not put them together? And I brought it to the band and they were like extremely skeptical. But I actually think it turned out to be kind of an almost seamless melody, you know, melodic mashup, the way the two tunes work together.
Oh, yeah, no question about it. All right, so let's do that. Let's play Sun and Water is, again, a nice intro from Allison Brown, who's been my guest today on Unreal Bluegrass. We're talking about On Banjo, her newest release on Compass Records. Let's play Sun and Water. We'll be right back, and we'll finish up with Allison and move on. All right, this is it, Sun and Water. That is Worth Waiting For, Sun and Water. I just really love the combinations. I love everything about that tune. I know it's out on video because I've seen it, and I think people should go see it as it's done. There's also, is there a video of Foggy Morning Breaking? I'm going to get that right now every time I mention this. Is there a video of that, or at least like a trailer that talks about it? Or is there?
Yeah.
Okay.
There is actually a video.
Okay.
Of us all in the studio doing that song.
Okay.
Song.
Yeah. So we've talked about the South American. I skipped over Choro enough, which is how I pronounce it, which is again another mm-hmm. South.
No, that's how I pronounce it too.
Okay. Yeah. And so you bring in, you have a great reed player flute. I've seen him before. I think I must have seen him with your band at Gray Fox. I think it's that guy. He had all these flutes around him on the thing and different kinds of instruments. Yeah. That's his name escapes me. Is it Josh?
It's John Ragusa.
John
and
Ragusa.
He is a great player, and he's great musical spirit.
His flute is just so gorgeous. So, but on this tune, you bring in a clarinet player. And you make reference in the liner notes to, I'm talking about the second cut on the album, you make reference to a Dixieland clarinet banjo type of thing. And I will tell you this too, totally unrelated. This many years ago, Eric Weisberg was on the show. And most of the show that, you know, we talked about his influence in the early 60s, but he went off on this thing where he said he can go point by point and tell you why Dixieland band matches up perfectly with a bluegrass band as we typically think of it. So you make mention of the fact of the banjo and the clarinet, and then you actually get a great player who I don't know at all, and I'm probably butchering his first name, I would say, Annette Cohen. I don't know if it's who it is, but explain that a little bit. I like that. Again, that's another South American thing. Then we'll move off of that.
Sure. So, in an interesting twist, Annette Cohen is actually a she.
I was going to say that. That's why I said I'm not sure how to pronounce the name, and I realized I'm not even sure who it is.
Yeah, she is an amazing jazz clarinet player. She's really well known in the jazz world. But I listen to and I watch her YouTube videos where she's playing with a Brazilian band, and she plays Brazilian choro music so beautifully. She's a really interesting person. I've never met her. I was introduced to her on email by Roger Brown when he was the president of Berklee College of Music. He just retired from that post. But he connected us, and I just reached out and I said, I'm a fan and I love your playing. Would you play on this tune? And she said yes. She was so nice. And so now we have we've still never met in person, but I can't wait to meet her in person. Yeah, she's has just such a sparkling personality, and as a musician, just such a great player. And it's interesting because the banjo and the clarinet are both kind of outliers in jazz, especially contemporary jazz.
Yeah.
You know, the banjo is there at the birth of jazz, but you don't really hear it in jazz anymore. So, and same with the clarinets, they're kind of like trapped in this Dixieland era of jazz, but they sound so beautiful together. And I can't remember who told me this, but I've heard that Pete Fountain was Earl Scruggs' favorite musician. He was
really?
A clarinet player.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, isn't that so interesting? Yeah. So there is a musical kinship there too between those two instruments, and it's something that I really look forward to exploring further. But for now, getting to play with Annette, at least virtually, was just such a privilege. Such
a great
musician.
Beautiful tone. It's just a really gorgeous sound that she gets on that. So yeah, you get to meet her. And so we've talked about different South American, and I don't want to give short shrift to choro music, which is a little different than samba or bossa novas. And I can't distinguish them. I know what they are, but I can't say why they're different. And if you can, fine. If not, we'll move on to your tune with Sharon Hisman. I'm happy to do that.
Yeah, sure. I'll reveal the depths of my ignorance and attempt to answer.
I always do.
As I understand it, choro music is traditional Brazilian folk music.
Okay.
That's how it's been explained to me, whereas bossa nova really was an innovation that Antonio Carlos Jobim is credited with, that was kind of, you know, born, I guess, coalesced in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, okay.
So I think before there was bossa nova, there was choro music.
Okay.
It's just folk tunes. And they're not too different from our fiddle traditions, especially those fiddle tunes that have multiple parts, like an A, B, C, D section. Because a lot of the choros are constructed that way too. And that was the fun of writing this tune, you know, was kind of adding on sections to it, just the way you would as if you were writing, you know, one of those Texas style fiddle tunes that has multiple parts. And it was great to write that with a knot in mind. And I was so glad that she agreed to record it with me. It kind of opened the door to something that I'd really like to explore further in the future.
Yeah, I hope so. I'll tell you this, back in, I guess after Song of the Banjo was released, which was about 2015, maybe, we were talking on Unreal Bluegrass about that album. And I, because I never leave well enough alone, I was just curious what you might be working on in the future. You just released Banjo, Song of the Banjo. So why not say, what else you got? So, but you mentioned this, that you were working on something with Sharon Nisbet. And I've been looking and waiting and thinking. So I love the story behind you, how you get to know her. And I like the fact that you've written this tune, with her, which is the seventh cut on the album. Talk a little bit about that tune for me. And also to the audience, if you could explain Sharon.
Of course. Well, first of all, Steve, I can't believe you remember that. But I remember that too. I remember telling you about that.
That's the Allison, that's the bad thing about being a trial attorney, is all those little sounds stick in my head. So words are music, and music is sound. They stick in my head. And that's just, I do remember.
Okay.
That. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, hats off to you for remembering that. Yeah, and I can't believe that I was thinking about it that far back. But yeah, Sharon Isbin is one of the most lauded guitarists in classical music. Yeah. In fact, I think she was the first classical guitarist to ever win a Grammy. And she's won a couple of them at this point. And she's just such an amazing player. And we were kind of paired with a cast of odd bedfellows to do a song at the pre-telecast awards at the Grammys. Right. So Sharon and I were paired to play together in a very interesting, eclectic cast of odd bedfellows for a song at the pre-telecast awards at the Grammys. And that would have been in the early 2010s. And it was a kind of an odd bedfellows bluegrass band. I was standing there next to Ray Benson from Asleep at the Wheel. I mean, it was a real interesting mix and match. But to start off the tune, Sharon played like a classical guitar thing, and then she joined in with the bluegrassy band. And so that's how we met, and we got to hang out a little bit because we had like rehearsal time and performance time and all of that. And so I got a chance to know her a little bit. And so as I was working on the new record, I thought, well, okay, I'll reach out to Sharon and see if she might be willing to do something together on the record. And she was like, absolutely, that would be a great thing to do. So I asked her if there was a tune in the classical repertoire that she thought would be an interesting duet for banjo and guitar. And she said, no, you're going to need to write something for me. So when I got over being completely,
I was going to say, okay,
you know, I am not worthy. That took a couple years. And then I was talking to Gary and like, what kind of thing should I even attempt to write? And he said, well, think about it more like a choro. And that was really good advice.
Okay.
And so that's how I came up with the tune Regalito. And I will say, right around that time, my kids were listening to the soundtrack from Coco, which is a brilliant soundtrack, the Disney movie.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's a lot of Coco inspiration in there, too.
Okay.
But an interesting just like fact that has really no bearing on anything is the fact that Sharon and I were both born on the same day, different years, same day. So that's why I named the tune Regalito. I thought of it as like a little gift to both of us.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's got plenty of triplets in it. That's something
that
I could take from bluegrass music, bluegrass banjo, and reapply in this slightly altered context.
I only got to see her perform once, and just was the way it worked out. She came through town. There was a great venue north of Cincinnati in Hamilton, Ohio, which was Miami University, a branch of Miami University. And she came. I couldn't wait to see her. I used to read lots of magazines. Acoustic Guitar was one of my favorites, and she had a regular column in there. And I always went to, I think it was Acoustic Guitar. Yeah, I think it was Acoustic. She had a regular column in there, and I would always read Sharon's articles. Like as soon as I got, I didn't understand it all, but I knew it meant something, and I knew it was important to try to absorb. And I got to see her play. It was just a magical evening for me. Never saw her since then, but she would come out and do, you know, classical musicians. There's not a lot of chatter, let's put it that way. So she'd come out and do her tunes and just then announce the next one and do that one. But I think, yeah, what a great thing to be able for you and for her to be able to play with you and for you to be able to play with her. I think what a great, and you're playing this again. I made a note about the low banjo. Are you also playing a different tuning for this tune?
Yeah, I am. So I wrote this tune on guitar. That was the only way I could figure that I could write something that I might not be too embarrassed to send. At least I would know that you could play it on the guitar, you know? And of course, like the key of E seemed to offer the most opportunity for triplets with the open strings and stuff, thinking about it like a bluegrass guitar player would, you know. So then I needed to try to figure out how to play it on the banjo, because I hadn't written it really with the banjo in mind. I wrote it with the guitar in mind. And so I turned to the low banjo because I could play out of the key of G in the key of E, if that makes sense. So I just, yeah, the low tune banjo tuned to an open E chord gave me the chance to have the open strings I needed to try to get some of those triplets in.
Well, I'm so glad you got a chance to do it. I enjoy it. It fits so well into this album because you're the sweep of different musical genres that Allison always brings in are just always, each one is like, wow, this is incredible. And it gives you another avenue for the listener. It gives you as a performer and a composer it gives you the opportunity to explore all these other things as we've discussed, but it gives the listener the opportunity to think, I'm going to look into that more. What a great thing. I should look into this Joe Beam guy. This Joe's been a busy guy.
He was a busy guy. He was quite prolific.
So that having been said, I think it was like 2020. I've always been a fan of the Kronos Quartet. And I didn't know that I bought the very first album they did, Black Narcissus. And I just, one of those things I had no, you used to be able to go into record stores, people, to give us a second here. Old people like me, you would go into a record store and just look around. Things that you wouldn't, weren't, but you would look around and I thought, this sounds really interesting. I thought it looks interesting. And it was the Kronos Quartet's first album. And in 2020, they released an album, Long Time Passing, which was a incredible collection of stuff they put together and original tunes and on Smithsonian about Pete Seeger. And as soon as it came out, I said, I'm going to take a shot. I take a shot on a lot of people, but I thought I'll take a shot on David Harrington. And so it was great. He was on the show. We talked about Kronos Quartet and had a blast. So the last tune on this is Porches, which is a tune that you do with the Kronos Quartet. People may not remember David Harrington being on the show, but how do you connect with the Kronos Quartet, and how does this explain a little bit about this tune?
Well, your backstory is really interesting because that's kind of how I connected with those guys. We were both playing the Freshgrass Festival in North Adams, Massachusetts, and I guess that would have been in 2019.
Yeah.
And they were recording that album, that Pete Seeger album, in the studio there that's attached to a kind of a boutique hotel that's called Porches. That right next door is Studio 9, and that's where they were working. So I had never met any of the guys in Kronos, and I started talking to David Harrington, and I was working on the tune that became Porches. And I knew I wanted to record it with a string quartet, so I got up my nerve and I asked David if they would consider recording it with me, not knowing at all. You know, it was another one of those I am not worthy moments, but the one thing I did know is that they were willing to associate with banjo player because they were doing the Pete Seeger project.
And
they couldn't have been more, he was just like, absolutely. So that's how Porches became Porches. First of all, I named it after the place where I met Kronos Quartet, and we had fully intended to record that together, but then the pandemic happened, you know, like 6 months later. So we ended up having to do that recording virtually too. They recorded their part at Luke Skywalker Sound in Marin, and I did my part at Compass in Nashville.
And it's impossible to throw any kind of a blanket over Kronos Quartet and David Harrington and what he does, his vision for music. And that, and the Smith, this Pete Seeger thing is just, it's an experience because of all the different parts that are brought in, the live discussions and all these new things and the old recordings. And you cannot, I don't want anyone to go away thinking, Kronos Quartet is like a bluegrassy kind of a folk. It's not. They do.
No.
You can't classify, each album is totally different. And everything they do is totally different, and I think it's mostly David Harrington looking in the wow.
I think that you're absolutely right about that, and yeah, I mean, they have the most wide-eyed musical vision of just about anybody you could think of. Certainly as a string quartet, they do. And
yeah.
I had someone say to me after they heard our version of Porches that was the most melodic thing they'd ever heard Kronos play.
I
was thinking, well, sure, it's like probably the most thing akin to what Stephen Foster might have done if he'd written the string quartet.
That's right. That's you made a good point. That's whoever said that. Yeah, that's so. Yeah, I appreciate that completely because they're totally different. Well, let's do one of the other guests that you have on this album is Sierra Hole, who just never stops to amaze me and never will stop amazing me. But Sweet 16th is the tune I want you to introduce, and that's with Sierra Hole. And then after we get into that, I'll let you go. But let's talk about Sierra. She pops up at least once or twice on the album.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Sierra Hall, I just think, is one of the most remarkable musicians ever. And my favorite mandolin player. Yeah, she's just, it's so inspiring to play with Sierra. You know how there are certain people that really lift your game up?
Mm-hmm.
Depending on whether you're talking about music, sports, or law, or anything, there are certain people that always make you be your best self. And I always feel that way about playing with Sierra. She's got the most delicate touch. She always reminds me that playing harder is not necessarily the best thing to do.
Yeah.
Her fingers just dance over that mandolin like little butterflies. It's amazing. And she lands everything she thinks of. And that's like that's something that I've worked my whole career to come, you know, to be able to do half the time, and she does it every time. So anytime I get to play with Sierra is always just a great moment, musical moment for me. And I've always loved banjo mandolin duets, going back to the early days of Sam Bush and Alan Lundy, probably, you know, on Poor Richard's Almanac record.
I've got it.
That was recorded.
And
yeah.
I've got it. And Alan and Sam together again for the first time.
Yes, exactly. That record too. I just love the sound of the banjo and mandolin together. So I wrote this tune with Sierra in mind, and she was gracious enough to learn all the notes, and there's more than one fistful full for sure. And she told me that when we were working on it, that there's an ascending line like about halfway through the tune that required her to use every fret on the first string of the mandolin to get every single fret. And I don't have any idea how she fingered that, but she like completely hooked it. It was truly amazing. And the other thing about, you know, this record is I was working on it, you know, being a female instrumentalist, it's like you are part of a very, I was going to say elite group, but it's a very small group of women who tend to be players rather than singers. I don't know why it is, but there are many fewer women who do that than there are men. And so I really wanted to pick out some of my favorite female, you know, virtuosos is such an overused word, but these women are such unicorns in that they're female and then they're just amazing instrumentalists, like no holds barred.
Yeah.
And so Sierra, you know, she's at the top of that list too. She's obviously a great singer, but she's, if all she did was play the mandolin, that would be enough for several lifetimes. And it's really remarkable.
It's a remarkable tune. And Allison, Sierra's, she's just beginning. She really, even though she's been in since she's a child, she has, her future is just, there's just no end in sight as to where she goes and what she can accomplish and what she wants to do. She's just that remarkable to me in her looking at music and playing music and digesting things, but her technical ability and also to play that so nicely. And just she, I think she's just, it's hard to say that someone we've known for so long, she's just beginning. She's really just kind of on the cusp of being Sierra Hall as an artist that she wants to be.
Yeah. Well, it's exciting because, you know, when you think about bluegrass music and you think about the fact that all its original architects were men, and now fast forward to, you know, 2023, and you've got people like Sierra Hall who are at the point of the spear,
absolutely,
you know, kind of shaping the direction for where this bluegrass and bluegrass rooted music is going to go.
Yeah.
It's pretty exciting, though, the perspective that they'll bring to the music and how it's going to grow in the future. I can't wait to see.
It's very exciting. I'm glad you came back to that point. And it's, as far as I'm concerned, it's very exciting because I get to hear more great music.
Well, we all do. So it's exciting for all of us.
Yeah, we all get more. The more the better. Everything, what's the thing about you raise the water and all the boats rise? I mean, to me, yes, inclusive. There are so many great. We could do a whole show just going through the great female instrumentalists and performers in bluegrass and beyond, because they do seem to go over.
We should do that, Steve. I'd sign up for that job, you know, because when I started playing banjo, there really weren't very many. And if you were looking for a mentor as a female musician, I can't even think of who you would point to as somebody who was really doing it at the highest level the way you have now.
Yeah.
And that was sort of the genesis for the First Ladies of Bluegrass project, was realizing that finally, after 27 years, a female musician had won Instrumentalist of the Year in every instrumental category.
That's right. Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Except for Dobro. We're still waiting for Dobro, but across the complement of a traditional bluegrass band anyway, the five most essential instruments. We finally had a woman win every category, and it took 27 years, like more than a quarter of a century. So it wasn't a given that it was going to happen.
No.
And now we're kind of really, I think the female perspective and voice in bluegrass music has really reached a tipping point, and like I was saying a minute ago, I think the future in this music really, you know, it may belong to the women. And that's very exciting to me.
I think it's great. And you're a big part of it. You're a big part of making that availability and opening those doors and windows and being there and supportive. Also, Allison, you're a big part of that future.
You're lips to God's ears.
I know you're very modest. I know you're a modest person because I've talked to you long enough to realize that. But, I mean, let's face it, you were a pioneer before there were pioneers. I mean, you were doing things. I saw you with Allison Krauss a gazillion years ago. Mm-hmm. Not that we're both gazillion. I'm pretty
proud. We're getting close.
Well, I am. I don't think you are yet, but I've seen you and watched you play for a long, long time. And, you were the one who helped. Yeah. I'll say you were the one who opened the doors and windows as much as any other instrumentalist that I know. And you were Banjo Player of the Year back a long time ago when not only was it not a common thing, it was just not even considered. And think of all the great players that have come. You're a part of it. You're not done. You're not done by any stretch of the imagination, but you were a big part of opening these doors and windows for people like we got off on this talking about Sierra Hall. But, I mean, that's just the reality of it.
Yeah, well, we all stand on the shoulders of the people that came before us. And there were some really tough female trailblazers in this music. And, you know, I talked to Alice Gerard and Hazel Dickens.
Oh, no question.
You know, Ginger Boatwright and the road that they it was a hard one. So they kind of definitely paved the way for Missy Raines and me and Lynn Morris and Claire Lynch. Our generation. Rhonda Vincent.
Yeah, every one of those I love.
It's powerful to have young women come up and say, you know, if I hadn't seen another woman do what you do, I never would have been able to imagine myself doing it. And so you can't really underestimate the power of having a mentor, somebody that looks like you doing that thing that you want to do. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know what that says about me having only had male banjo heroes, the hairy legged variety, but I definitely think it helps for young women these days to be able to look at Sierra Hall or, you know, Bronwyn and see her playing amazing fiddle, Tuttle playing guitar, yep. Shelby Means playing bass. You know, there are so many now.
I just saw them.
If you're a young girl starting out, man, there's so many people that you could model yourself after.
I just saw the last three you mentioned in Lexington two weekends ago. Molly was there with her band.
They're crushing it. I'm so proud of all of them. Mm-hmm. It's really a sea change in this music. For anyone who's getting into it now, they may not realize how much of a sea change it is. But just step back 60 years and look at the bluegrass landscape.
Step back, appreciate that, and make it customary now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, make it customary now that women are always in these spots, but always remember what the path was. But also, let's make it all so regular and so brilliant that we think of the brilliance as opposed to it's not there yet. It's getting there. I think it's close.
Yeah,
I think it's close.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, parity is still a ways off, but we're definitely getting close. And there's definitely no turning back.
No.
You know, it's like, in my opinion, it's the yin and the yang. It's like the balance of things. There need to be, there's no reason to oppress women's voices when they have so much to bring to the music.
No.
In fact, I've long felt that women were the best ambassadors for bluegrass music, because if you're not familiar with the style and the first thing you hear is Del McCrory sing kind of a high lonesome vocal. You may not know how to relate to that.
Yeah.
But if the first thing you hear is Claire Lynch or Molly Tuttle or Lori Lewis
sing,
then you're like, oh, okay, I get this. Yeah. I like this, you know? So, and I think that was one of the reasons why Alison Krauss was just such a watershed artist in bluegrass music. You know, who couldn't love Alison's voice? It didn't matter if you've never loved bluegrass or still don't like bluegrass when you hear Alison sing.
I saw her.
That's just perfect.
We were with her, and it was one of Ricky Skaggs' picking parties. He didn't do too many, but the one that I saw was the first actual onstage gathering of JD in the New South. Everybody was back. And you were there this was in Cincinnati, and you were there with Allison I think it was still in the Union Station. And then it was just an amazing 5 hours of all these great Stanley brothers and everybody that was up and around. But that's why. And I had no idea who she was, because how could I? So as we go into the venue, you hear music and you're thinking, it was her. They were playing her music as you're finding your seat. And I thought, who is that? What is that voice? And she came out and you came out with her. And I thought, oh, my God, that's it. What? And it was nothing that wasn't absolutely appealing instantly to her.
Yeah. No, I know. It's just the voice of an angel for sure.
Yeah. Hey, listen, we're going to play because you've already set up Sweet 16th, which I'm going to do. But here's something for you to look up while we hang up. The phrase, if I've seen further, it's because I stood on the shoulders of giants, which you sort of mentioned earlier. Look it up and tell me who actually said that for the first time. And don't tell me now. I'll see you somewhere and you can tell me who is responsible for that phrase, because I always get it wrong. But I get it wrong, and I like my wrong answer better than the real answer. But with that being said, I'll say goodbye to Alison Brown, and we'll play Sweet 16th, which is, we didn't even talk about Wind the Clock, but we talked about most everything else on the album. But Sweet 16th with Sierra Hall, this is on Banjo, which is Alison Brown's new album on Compass. Is it fully available? Is it fully been released? I think it has by now, hasn't it?
Yeah, the record came out in May, and it's available in digital and physical formats everywhere.
I got them all. Okay, yeah. Alison, thank you so much for making time. I know you're so busy. And so we'll say goodbye to you, and I'll play for the audience Sweet 16th. And again, thank you so much for everything that you do for music and spending some time with me every once in a while.
Well, it's always great to chat with you. Will you be at Grey Fox this year?
I will be. Are you looking up If I Stand on the Shoulders of Giants?
I'm not. But okay.
I heard a keyboard strike. That's all.
Yes, you did hear a keyboard strike because I'm still working on the logistics of transportation lesson.
I've
got that.
I don't want you looking that up until we're done. So do that. We'll listen to. Yes, I'll be at Grey Fox. I will be. Yes, indeed. I guess I will.
Okay.
Okay. I'll see you up there.
We will be too. And I'll look forward to it. Please, I saw you across a crowded room last year. I don't think we got to say hi, but please.
No, we really didn't. I'll find you. Okay. Alison Brown, this is Sweet 16th from On Banjo, and we'll connect later on down the road. Okay.
I'll look forward to it, Steve. Thank you so much for doing this interview.
Thank you. Bye bye.